Welcome to Appaloosa Radio, where stories come alive. Appaloosa Radio is a service of the Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater. Rubber Stamps. Part 2. Jody Carn's Heart. In 1962, my parents sold our suburban, Southern California home and used the money to open a printing business. We moved from our home and rented instead a former store with a small house attached in back. When your business is attached to your home, you can never get away. Customers would interrupt our meals, wake us at night, and expect us to entertain their children while they made their selections. It also meant that we could never entertain or have friends over. The business dominated everything. The whole enterprise started when my father responded to an ad in the popular Mechanics magazine.
For a $250 investment, you can start your own at-home business manufacturing custom rubber stamps.
For his $250, my father received a press, called the Vulcanizer, 3 sheets of a pressed asbestos matrix board, 2 12 by 12 inch sheets of gum rubber, and 4 feet of rubber stamp handle molding. For an additional $50, he received an assortment of lead type, and a so-called kerning stick. The ad was right, those are the basic elements one needs to go into the rubber stamp manufacturing business. The technology remains still unchanged since the 1920s when it was invented. The key element is the vulcanizer. It has heating elements for melting the gum rubber, combined with a jack press for applying pressure, forcing the melted gum rubber into the matrix board mold. To make a rubber stamp, someone has first to select the individual type letters, and assemble them, in reverse, on the kerning stick, placing spacing, kerning, as needed between the letters and elements of the stamp. Once the type is set, it locked into a steel frame, and placed in the vulcanizer. On top of the steel frame, a sheet of the pressed asbestos matrix board is placed. The matrix board is composed of 3 layers, a thin, but hard upper layer, a softer middle layer, and a firm, thick base. The vulcanizer is heated up and the jack press is pumped to create pressure on the matrix board. In about 5 minutes, the type has been imprinted into the matrix board, and the steel frame holding the type is removed and allowed to cool. The imprinted matrix board becomes the mold for the gum rubber. A sheet of gum rubber is laid over the matrix board, and again the jack press is pumped up. When hot enough, the gum rubber forms into the matrix board mold, and the pressure of the vulcanizer is released. Once the gum rubber is cooled, it is cut to size and the excess removed. A section of the rubber stamp molding is cut to size, and the gum rubber stamp is glued onto it using rubber cement. The vulcanizer that my father purchased for his initial $250 used a metal rod to hand pump the jack press. Today's version of vulcanizers have hydraulic pumps that do that work instead. Still, my father's version lasted for over 25 years, and made many thousands of rubber stamps. My family's plan had always been to sell rubber stamps as an auxiliary service to its printing operations. However, they made a terrible mistake, one that haunted the business throughout its existence. They chose the wrong technology. As a direct result of that one decision, the enterprise became a small-scale rubber stamp business, run almost solely by my mother. In 1963, a man, whose name and affiliation I never knew, visited our print shop and talked my parents into applying for a small business administration loan. I remember my mother assembling records and filling out forms. I remember her taking special phone calls which I was forbidden to interrupt. I remember the excitement everyone felt when the loan was finally approved. I now look back and know that was really the bleakest day for my parents' business aspirations. The SBA loan created obligations and restrictions that my parents could never overcome. In the early 1960s, the American printing industry was undergoing what would later be regarded as a revolution. Printing was no longer a skilled craft using expensive, precision machinery located in large specially designed plants. Instead, the industry was moving toward quick print retail shops where fast turnaround and low cost triumphed over everything else. The catalysts for this change were the offset press and the paper printing plate. For centuries, printing had meant rolling ink onto movable type, and then pressing paper onto the ink type to receive the final image. At the beginning of the 20th century, an actual person, a typesetter, handset the type. A compost to ensure that the printing frame into which the type was locked was well composed. And the printer ran the printing press, ensuring that paper flowed smoothly through the equipment and the press inks were applied uniformly. This classic mode of printing came to be designated as letterpress printing. In the late 1930s, an alternate system of printing was perfected. It was named offset printing. Instead of printing from movable type, an image would be etched onto a metal plate, and the press would print it from it. The image was offset onto the paper. In offset printing, an image is etched onto the plate through a photochemical process. Traditionally, offset printing was a better choice than letterpresses for material requiring multicolor or that had multiple photographs. Until the late 1950s, offset printing required a metal plate and special equipment for the photochemical etching. This meant that for many jobs, offset printing was more expensive than letterpress printing. However, in the late 1950s, new low-cost offset presses entered the market. They were joined by the paper printing plate, which could be quickly processed using equipment similar to what was used in Polaroid instant cameras. For jobs of less than 3,000 impressions, the paper printing plate was cheaper and easier to use than the older metal plates. And, in contrast to the letterpress, paper plate technology represented a savings of over 90%. There were other advantages to the paper plate technology. The newer offset printing presses were much smaller and lighter than the older letter presses. That meant the cities allowed them into retail shops. Printing was no longer isolated in the outer industrial regions, it could move into a shop next to the drugstore and the flower shop. It was also substantially quicker. Many companies advertised that they could print while you wait in less than 20 minutes. The industry became known as quick print. The quick print revolution had one additional component. The advent of the IBM Selectric typewriter allowed customers to create their own camera-ready copy quickly by simply typing. No typesetting was needed. Additionally, there was the strange invention of rub-on type. If you were designing a print job and you needed a bold headline or some fancy script, you could buy a plastic sheet which had letters that you could easily rub onto your design's original. I remember that I used rub-on type to create interest in my very first resume. I believe that a sheet of rub-on type cost about a dollar and it was available in every stationery store. Again, no typesetting was needed. Anyone could do it themselves. A customer could come into a quick print shop with camera-ready copy they had prepared themselves, give the copy to the printer, who could shoot and process the paper plate in 10 minutes, put the paper plate on the press and run the print job. Everything would be finished in a couple of hours, and the cost would be well below what a traditional letterpress shop would have to charge. My parents opted for the wrong technology. They used their loan money to purchase a very expensive German-made printing press. It could easily handle paper of many sizes from very small to very large. It had six massive rollers to ensure full, even ink coverage. It was fast, printing nearly 3,000 sheets an hour. It was a beautiful piece of German engineering. The problem was that it was a letterpress that printed from type. For the money they had spent on the German behemoth, they could have purchased three or four offset presses and all the photochemical processing equipment needed for burning both paper and metal plates. My father had believed that the German-made machine would be perfect for fine-quality printing jobs, like printing wedding announcements. It was specially designed for printing on expensive linen or vellum papers. Printing clean, crisp copies without smudges or extraneous ink marks. It printed beautifully on linen paper. There was no smearing. It perfectly stacked each printed invitation away from the others to preserve crispness. The press was a wonder to watch, gears and pistons, multiple precision parts moving in unison. It even seemed to sing as it printed. The problem was that our business had almost no orders for wedding invitations. In our area, the stationery stores dominated the wedding invitation business. Most stores had a specially decorated corner reserved just for romantic couples, where the couples could find every product they needed for their wedding and reception. To be sure, the stationery stores did not actually print their own invitations and announcements. No, they ordered these items from one of the four large printing firms in Los Angeles that printed only wedding invitations. Of course, the LA printing firms gave our local stationery stores wholesale pricing. The LA companies could print, box, in a specially decorated keepsake box, and ship an order for less than it cost my parents just to buy the high-quality, linen paper. The German press was also great for printing large signs, but to be honest, I do not recall ever seeing an order for signs. In fact, there were many weeks when the huge German press was never turned on. When my parents realized the extent of their mistake, they called the SBA lender and asked whether they could sell the German press and buy something else. They were told that it was principal collateral for the loan and could not be sold. Here is what made the situation a real catch-22. When my parents signed the loan, they were told that if they were to close their business, the full amount of the original loan would become immediately due and payable. All of which brings me back to rubber stamps. The original printing business was a failure. My father left the business and found a job as a maintenance electrician in a local school district. However, for the next 20 years, my mother operated a business manufacturing rubber stamps using the vulcanizer that my father had originally purchased for $250. On a good day, she would make 10 rubber stamps. On a more typical day, she would make 4 or 5. Some days, she made none, but those were far fewer than I thought they would be. Most of her customers were one-time buyers. That is the way it is in the rubber stamp market. Simply do not wear out. She branched out into selling business cards which were printed by a specialty firm in LA, but the bulk of her business was rubber stamps. She kept the business running for 20 years, paying her bills and making some profit. Eventually, the dreaded SBA loan was paid off and they could sell the unused printing equipment. Then, as her retirement approached, she found a buyer for her business, so she walked away from it with cash in her hand. So, there you have it, the three technologies that most impacted my mother's working life: the Montgomery Ward's mail order catalog, the 10-key adding machine, and the vulcanizer. What to make of this? First, I am struck by how transformative innovation can directly emerge from a specific person's prior experience. It is not just doing the same things over and over again. No, I mean that these individuals took their prior experience, gave them just a small tweak, and something wholly new emerged. Aaron Montgomery Ward had worked as a clerk in a Michigan general store before he left for Chicago to become a traveling salesman. As a traveling salesman, he often used printed catalogs with woodcut illustrations to sell his products to various wholesale jobbers. These wholesale jobbers, in turn, sold the items to the rural general stores, who finally sold them to the end customer. On one of his trips, he gave those prior experiences a very slight mental tweak. Why couldn't I give my rural retail customers the catalogs instead of the wholesale jobbers? They could buy items directly from me by mail order. Ward's mental tweak was relatively small, but its ramifications were huge. Mail order catalogs generated hundreds of millions of dollars in sales and literally transformed the retail industry. I think also of Julius Rosenwald, whose prior experiences had been in operating high-quality men's clothing stores. As Rosenwald reflected on his own retail experiences, he too made a slight mental tweak. In his prior businesses, customers were made to feel welcome and valued, informed about alternatives, and given real choices. When he reviewed the early mail order catalogs, he saw a general store in print form. Items were thrown together wherever they fit on the page. Order forms were hard to find, there were no indexes, and the copywriters often waxed senselessly poetic instead of simply and accurately describing the item. Rosenwald decided to create a book that had the feel and character of his retail stores. Organized, informative, and customer-oriented. I also think of that unknown Sears manager who decided that catalog orders could be taken by phone, and not just through the mails. A small tweak to what the company was already doing, but one with big ramifications. Of course, not only were items shipped faster, but the change also brought a different customer, the housewife instead of the farmer. Additionally, phone ordering facilitated the development of the company's credit card division. All the phone operator had to say after the order had been placed was, "Do you want to use your Sears card?" To move forward in time, I also think of Jeff Bezos, who, as everyone knows, began his business by buying and reselling used college textbooks. His simple tweak, "I could probably get and sell more books by using the internet," created the giant that Amazon is today. Transformative innovation can come directly from a small tweak to one's prior experiences. The second principle that strikes me is that sometimes an objective, clear-headed view of current reality can force radical change. I think specifically of General Robert Wood, the longtime president of Sears. General Wood had been the quartermaster general for the U.S. Army during World War I. He fully understood the logistics of large supply chains. He knew how to procure and distribute goods and material to meet the needs of a large and complex organization. In hiring him after his army retirement, Montgomery Ward believed that it had hired a logistical genius who would benefit the company in its continuing war against the hated Sears. When Wood joined the corporate staff of Montgomery Ward, he quickly saw that company was working from the wrong view of current reality. Montgomery Ward still had its focus on rural farmers. When the former general walked around Chicago, he did not see farmers. Instead, he saw cars, millions of cars. By 1920, everyone had a car, even the rural farmers that Ward sold to. The general proposed a business refocused on customers who drove cars. His idea was for a drive-up department store with ample free parking. The elderly Thorne brothers who still ran Ward's could not see the reality that Wood saw. So, they fired him. Within months, the general was working for Sears, building hundreds of drive-up department stores in suburban locations. The suburban, drive-up department store is now so common, many do not realize how truly innovative it was. Previous department stores were built downtown on the most exclusive commercial streets. Nearly all catered to the wealthy, sophisticated customer. Sears drive-up department stores sold nice, but not extravagant merchandise priced so a typical suburban family could afford them. They were in the suburbs because open land was cheaper there. Free parking required lots of parking spaces. Today, companies like Target, Walmart, and Kohl's build retail stores that are direct descendants of General Wood's originals. For General Wood, the automobile posed such a pressing reality that it could not be ignored. His was not innovation for the sake of innovation, his was because reality required it. There is a sense in which Sewell Avery met the technical definition of change agent. Things were very different at Montgomery Ward and Company after he brutally reconstructed it. However, for me, a change agent is a positive role. I cannot grant that Sewell Avery played a positive role at Ward's. What he shows, I believe, is that innovation and profitability are two very different vectors. Profitability rose, but innovation fell. Ward's became the Sears look-alike. If Sears did it, Ward's wanted to do it. However, being a look-alike did not create long-term customer loyalty. When I was growing up, there was both a Sears store and a Ward's store about equidistant from our house. We always shopped at Sears. I don't remember going into Ward's. Remember, my mother had worked at Ward's. She told us stories about her days working there. However, those memories did not bring her shopping loyalty. I think I know now why. Sears always seemed cleaner, less cluttered, and its merchandise always seemed fresher. Therefore, I assert that instead of being a Sears clone, Ward's was really a want-to-be clone that never completely matched the original. Still, there was one event during the tenure of Sewell Avery that represented a bright spot of innovation, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It shows that even in the bleakest of corporate dungeons, a truly innovative event can occur. The project began because Sewell Avery wanted to cut costs. Traditionally, Ward's had given each child who visited Santa in one of its toy lands a Christmas storybook. Avery believed that he could produce a book cheaper in-house than he could buy one from a publisher. One of the ironies of the Rudolph story is that Sewell Avery was seeking to downsize his copywriting department and had already fired many employees and reduced the salaries for the rest. The writer assigned to create the children's book, Robert May, was also enduring the death of his wife from cancer, so Rudolph was written in a time of personal sorrow. Rudolph first went to press in August 1939. Because of its popularity, it was given multiple press reruns. Eventually, during the 1939 Christmas shopping season, Ward's distributed 2.4 million copies of it. After the war, Ward's brought Rudolph back, distributing nearly 4 million copies in the 1946 shopping season. However, Ward's always viewed Rudolph as a Christmas gimmick with no value beyond the increase in toy sales. In 1947, Ward's sold all rights to the story's original author, Robert May, for what proved to be pocket change. After acquiring all rights, May and his brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, who was a songwriter, created the iconic song that Gene Autry eventually recorded. I assert that had Rudolph been the media property of a company like Walt Disney or Louis B. Mayer's MGM Studios, which had its own animation studios, it might have become as valuable as Mickey Mouse is today. Neither Robert May nor his songwriting brother-in-law knew what to do with Rudolph after the Gene Autry recording. They had created a phenomenal media property but did not have the knowledge or the resources to develop it to its fullest potential. Robert May took his profits, bought a comfortable home in a Chicago suburb, and let Rudolph slip away. Rudolph was a flash of pure brilliance that could have been so much more. I shared earlier that my mother said her most satisfying work experience was as the bookkeeper for the Norwegian family's companies. There she was trusted to solve problems, appreciated for her hard work and dedication, and validated in her self-worth. She left only because my father came home, and she became pregnant with me. They did not want her to leave and even offered to pay for a nanny if she would come back to work. She had increased their efficiency, one girl did the work previously done by three men. More importantly, she had opened new opportunities for them. With her 10-key adding machine, she could create more accurate and timely estimates, and thus make bids which were more likely to be profitable. It has become a truism among those who develop new technologies that labor efficiencies result. Just one worker will be able to replace many others. Those developers often point to agriculture where one worker in an air-conditioned cab, probably listening to their favorite music, uses technology to do the work that needed 50 farmhands a century ago. My mother's personal story bears out at least some of that truism. The right employee with the right technology can reduce labor costs. However, I view the situation from a different angle. It took a world war, and the loss of their entire team of bookkeepers, for the tradition-bound family to give a girl a chance to show her abilities. Once given the opportunity, Josie showed that she could make a difference. The 10-key adding machine was a tool, not the cause. Until I began this essay, I had given little thought to my father's wartime activities. Staying true to his top-secret oath, he never really discussed them. As I now reflect on what he did, I realize that developing, installing, and maintaining automated, remote weather technology required substantial engineering effort and large financial costs. From my quick research, I believe that the radio stations were developed at the Bell Labs and used RCA Victor vacuum tubes. Most of the sensors were developed specifically for the weather system. It was developed to give upper-level decision-makers real-time information. In a war where aircraft played the central role, weather information was crucial. Every military operation is also affected by weather. However, air operations are wholly governed by weather conditions. Not only was the weather information gathered in real time, it was also kept top secret. Decision makers did not want opponents to have the same advantage. Weather information was sent coded, precluding enemy hacking and data theft. Today, there is intense public discussion about the desirability of systems that gather data from multiple points in real time. Key decision makers see them as indispensable. Others, however, worry about the uses to which the data will be applied. They worry about potential loss of privacy, the potential loss of control, and the possibility that someone will use the real-time data to harm or exploit others. Such worries could have been expressed about the remote weather systems my father installed and maintained. However, in wartime, during the 1940s, no one did or would. The weather maps that my father's unit created were used to directly guide the long-range bombers which firebombed Japan. And these same weather maps also guided the two B-29s that dropped the first atomic bombs. Top secret, real-time information was collected to give the United States a strategic advantage. To get it required creating expensive, first-generation technology. Placing that technology where it needed to be brought considerable hardship for the men like my father who installed and maintained it. Keeping everything secret blocked communication, even to spouses, so my mother never knew the role that my father was playing. Still, ask any Army Air Corps general whether it was worth it, and you will get a quick and firm yes. You can still buy a rubber stamp vulcanizer today. This week, I saw several advertised on the web. Prices began at $15,000 and go up. Today's vulcanizer represents the new and improved version, more gauges, smooth hydraulic jacks, safety keys to prevent operator harm. In my parents' business, our antiquated machine was never actually called a vulcanizer. That was a much too sophisticated word. It was the stamp press, plain and simple. It had one pressure gauge, but I don't recall that it ever worked. It had a bar for hand pumping the jack press, and an on-off to release the jack's pressure, but no on-off switch. My father wired it up to its own circuit and placed a switch in a metal box to power it up. It had two options, hot and off. The three descriptors that seem to best describe the machine are basic, primitive, and rudimentary. Yet, it made money for the business, and it did so year after year. It also made money for the man who eventually bought her business. My father originally bought it as a part of a kit for a do-it-yourself, home business. The kit cost $250. My mother charged $3.50 a line for each rubber stamp that she made. The vulcanizer paid for itself within the first 75 lines of rubber stamps that it processed. It teaches a simple lesson, functionality does not need complexity. I am ending this ramble with what is for me is the most difficult section for write. The conclusion is clear, selecting the wrong technology can bring severe personal and financial harm. I am, of course, thinking of my own parents. I witnessed how much they had to give up, how much personal and financial pain they had to endure, and how much the wrong decision affected not only the quality of their life, but their health as well. They had sold their suburban home to start a business, and they lived in a small house attached to it. The business ate all their financial resources and left them in virtual poverty. They acquired some larger customers, who perpetually either refused to pay or paid well after the bill was due. Still, the companies they bought supplies from required cash on delivery. The small business loan seemed like a godsend. It gave them the cash they needed to really get off the ground. However, my parents used it to buy technology, the wrong technology for their needs. The wrong technology for the markets they were entering, the wrong technology in terms of the future of their industry. My mother once did the calculations as sort of an intellectual enterprise. If they had purchased the equipment necessary to start a typical quick print operation, they would have still had enough funds from the loan to operate the business for about 6 months. Likewise, had they foregone printing themselves, and instead purchased all of their printing from the LA firms, they would have still made money. A cute shop that offered cookies and punch to young couples while they were looking for wedding invitations would have cost very little to start but would have been immediately profitable. Finally, had they entered just the rubber stamp business and sold nothing else, they would have still created a profitable business. It was the behemoth German press that drove the business into the red ink. Sure, it was fast, and it could easily handle a variety of paper sizes and types. But it was a dinosaur heading for immediate extinction even as it was unloaded from the truck and wheeled into the shop. The wrong technology can bring severe harm.